And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us, Evelyn Lees from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Well, we continue to have a moderate avalanche danger in both the Park City area mountains and for those who are heading over to the western Uintas. Both areas have the same two issues. The first are wind slabs, which have been forming over the last 4 or 5 days, and we do have increasing southerly winds today, so we may even get a few new wind slabs sitting on those old hard ones. So those can be triggered by people on steep slopes. The second issue is we've got those faceted weak layers in the mid elevation or the mid part of the snowpack and near the ground. And every single day it seems like one or two slides are being triggered both in the central Wasatch and over in the Uintas on these deeper weak layers. So those are kind of the more serious concern. And with that storm that was just described on your weather forecast, people need to realize, especially even starting tomorrow with the strong winds in the forecast, the avalanche danger is going to increase over the next few days.
Okay, Evelyn, thanks so much. Right now, though, on the phone with me, I have Kim Carson. She's making her way down to the Utah Legislature, a member of the Summit County Council. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Leslie.
So as we reported, the container bill, which includes a ban to bag plastic bags, has been revived. And what we thought was an essentially dead bill, I guess they got more senators in the room and approved it. It now goes to the House. What do you think happened there?
It's hard to say. I think there's pressure from the grocery industry to continue to allow the bags. And, you know, there's some legislators that feel that, you know, counties and cities don't know best. But, of course, we always are going to side on local control, and this is one of those issues.
During public comment, she had a couple of students from Park City Day Skill give a speech supporting the ban on plastic bags. Do you think the county would follow the lead of Park City and ban them?
You know, we've continued to have discussions. Once this bill came up in the legislature, of course, we've been waiting to see what happens. But we'll continue to have conversations this year on this. It is a big issue, and I do plan on today taking the letters from those young women down to our legislators. And I'm going to, since it's already passed through the Senate, I'm going to focus on our House representatives.
All right, let's see. Another topic, you said the council is supportive of ending the death penalty here in the state of Utah. Anything that you want the Utah Association of Counties to do here?
You know, last week in our UAC meeting, and that's the Utah Association of Counties, we had a lobbyist for the Sheriff Association talk about he was adamantly opposed to abolishing the death penalty and was giving a number of reasons. And they were asking for UAC to take a position to oppose that. And some of us said, you know what, I don't know that that's the position of our counties, and we want time to research this a little more and talk to our constituents. And so it is going to be discussed this morning, and on behalf of Summit County, I'm going to speak in support of abolishing the death penalty. And we haven't had extensive conversations about this as a council, but I have polled a number of our elected officials, I mean all the council members, and of course the county attorney. Plan on spending a little more time, hopefully, talking to our sheriff this morning before I go into that meeting. And my biggest issues are that it's applied unfairly. Each county attorney has the ability to decide whether they're going to seek the death penalty for aggravated murder. And so right there, it's a discriminatory process. And African-Americans are, you know, less than 13% of the population, and these aren't specific to Utah. Of course, it's even less here. But they're one of the highest populations that are on death row. And 156 people have actually been exonerated and released from death row. So there's those that are convicted wrongly.
Yeah.
So I think there's just another. They've also shown that the death penalty is not a deterrent from violent crime, from committing violent crime. So.
All right. Let's move on. The Solid Waste Management Plan was presented. A number of ideas suggested here for recycling, in particular ones that will affect commercial businesses, perhaps a recycling ordinance placed on them. There is a pilot program, I think, to recycle cardboard. Or do you think businesses are going to go along with these ideas?
Well, you know, it needs to be a partnership. That, we found, is probably one of the biggest areas where we can reduce what goes into the landfill and make additional space, help our landfill last longer. So it's really critical that we work directly with them. There's already programs that are happening in areas where they're doing it very successfully, but it's going to be a partnership of us looking at how we can best implement that. And we're talking about starting as a pilot program or doing the study and planning the first year, starting it as a pilot, and then the third year transitioning into enforcement.
Another proposal is to operate a trash operation in-house. So does this mean that the county becomes its own Republic Services?
Yes, and that's something that I don't know wasn't one of the strong recommendations from the committee, but it is a consideration, and so that'll be an area that'll be studied further.
The staff put forward 8 proposals. Do we know the total price tag of all of them?
We don't, but it's several million dollars. You know, every year we spend over $5.5 million on waste collection and disposal, and we process over 51,000 tons of garbage or of waste. So, you know, our goals are to divert as much as we can from going into the landfill.
So to pay for this, we're looking at an increased sales tax, which would eventually become a countywide trash service district. How much are we talking about?
Well, we didn't get into the specifics of that, of what the actual tax increment would be. It would be part of our local option sales tax. And we're talking about doing that on a temporary basis to be able to start some of the diversion programs and planning for a transfer center. But then we would transition that in to a waste special service district. So it would be its own mill levy.
So,
and in that case, then we would go back and remove the sales tax. And we had a conversation on whether we would go back, you know, and what that would mean for our yearly billing, which it equates to $3 per month. Most likely that would go away. But, you know, this isn't a cheap proposition, but it's something, you know, we don't have the option either of not addressing it.
You had a joint meeting with the Snyderville Planning Commission and Eastside Commission on the newest housing need assessment. Lots of data here. Let's just talk about some basic numbers. An overall demand for some 414 units per year. The 5-year demand for units occupied by renters is like 1,400 units. Did this updated study tell you anything that we didn't already know?
Well, I think it has more specific numbers. And if you want to dig down into the data on, you know, rentals versus owner-occupied units, it did give us some good information. Part of our discussion, though, was do we have all the information we need? Are there other data sets that we need to look at? And a couple that were brought up was looking at making sure we have a good inventory of what's already built. You know, we have our bigger projects, of course, that we know of, like Canyon Corners and Liberty Peak Apartments. But we aren't sure that we are tracking all of the individual units that were built. Like, there's a couple just one-unit projects where, you know, somebody built a smaller 7 or 8 home subdivision, and they had to have one affordable unit in that. So we just need to double check and make sure that we have a really good inventory and that those are being monitored to make sure that we actually have low income or people within the appropriate AMI living in those.
Commissioner Glenn Wright said that we should think about tall buildings with lots of density to have for affordable housing. Is that something we should consider?
You know, I don't know that he's, you know, he's not talking skyscrapers, but even Jim Wood brought that up. He said, you know, you can't provide effective, affordable housing and have it be part of urban sprawl and expect people to get out of their cars. So when we look at affordable housing, we need to make sure that there's access to transportation in those areas. And with the cost of land in our community, we have to be able to build higher than just your typical two-story building. And I think, you know, I know even in initial conversations for the Klein-Dahl parcel, you know, we've talked about two- to four-story buildings.
Now, Councilmember Doug Clyde had said, we can't build 400 units a year and also integrate them with upper-income housing. So does that mean we have to live with some segregation of units?
Well, there will be some that will be standalone. And I think also it means right now on the books we have a 20% affordable housing requirement for every development approved. And so look at, you know, if you were going to get 10 units, that means you have 40 other units that are being built that are increasing our demand for services in the community and the requirement, you know, for more support type jobs. So that's just exacerbating our problem. So we need to, one of the things the Planning Commissions will be doing is going back and looking at that part of the code and possibly adjusting that. And then also we don't have a multifamily zone within our development code, so we need to look at that. And then, like on the east side, what type of infrastructure is required to support multifamily? And are there areas we feel are really appropriate for it?
Okay. Kim, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Okay, thank you. Good luck.
Let's bring on now Park City Planning Commissioner John Phillips. Good morning, John. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So the Planning Commission met last night with a minimum quorum. You had, they're kind of waiting for the City Council to appoint five new members. You have reapplied for another term. Why is that something you want to do again? Treasurer didn't beat it out of you, huh?
No. You know, I actually do enjoy doing it and just being part of the process. And I feel like it's a way to give back to the community. So I'm up for another 4 years if they choose to appoint me. Laura Susser also put in her application.
And then we had, I think, like 11 other applicants that have been interviewed since. Mm-hmm. So we should know either this week or perhaps at next week's meeting.
Yeah, it'll be coming soon.
Yeah. Did it create any problems having a small commission at last night's meeting?
No, it was a very small agenda with nothing that really had major importance. I think it was probably designed that way. I would imagine, I think our first meeting in March is also kind of a more mellow meeting, light agenda, and then I think we'll start kicking it in gear again.
To get people on board, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. Well, let's talk briefly about just the forestry draft. I mean, we've got the city engineer presenting the draft for the forestry plan, and it calls for hiring a forestry manager?
Yeah, so they want to create a position for a forestry manager. They were talking about hopefully finding someone in the staff somewhere in Marsac, I believe. And I know Bruce had put a lot into it. His name was thrown out there, but we all know that he's got his plate full. So they'll do that and then also form a board, which they said would probably be accomplished within 3 to 6 months.
So are we putting that cart before the horse? I mean, if we're going to have somebody do a forestry, become forestry manager, and we're doing the plan before that person has been hired, does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think that the people that have put the effort into this forestry plan really know what they're doing, and so I don't think so. I think that this plan is a collaboration of many individuals. Who knows, maybe that manager will come out of that list of people that did put it together. But I think the plan is where most of most of the work is put in, and then the manager can come in and implement that plan.
So is this a full-time job that we're talking about?
I wouldn't imagine it's a full-time job, no.
Commissioner Doug Timm had some concerns about the introduction of non-local species of trees. Can you explain why that's a good idea?
They did talk about it. I'm trying to recall what the staff's response was to that. I believe it's not new. I don't think it's new trees, but there are a lot of trees that are not native trees that are planted all around town. So I think that that's what they're referring to. And a lot of them are encouraged. A lot of them do work. I think a big part of it is discouraging certain trees that have proven to not grow well here in Park City, so we don't end up with a lot of brown trees.
Okay. And then with the Park City Heights Phase 2, there was, I think, a request for a phasing plan amendment. Did you guys go ahead and approve that?
We didn't approve it last night because it was noticed. One part in the staff report, it was noticed for us to have action actually at our next meeting. Or actually, no, on the 28th. Of March.
Okay.
Or our last meeting in March. So we felt like we were in a place that we could have, but we wanted to make sure that we followed the proper process.
Okay, John, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
It's 8:47 now. Good morning. Joining me now in the studio, the executive director of the Park City Chamber Bureau, Bill Malone. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you're here just to kind of give us a little bit of a legislative update. Let's start with tourism funding. That's always a biggie for you in terms of your budgeting.
Sure. This last year we had the state allocated $21 million towards Utah Office of Tourism and actually the Tourism Performance Marketing Fund. The governor's budget this year went in with a 22.5 request in that. We think that there is a possibility that it could be more than that. The fact that, the legislature does have quite a bit of a surplus this year, as well as the fact that it qualifies because it has a formula attached to it, and it qualifies for up to $24 million. So we're anxious to see what happens, but that's one of those things we usually don't find out until the 11th hour on the last day of the session. So it's always a target for someone's pet project to go after those funds.
Is it its own bill, or is it kind of lumped with something
else? It's lumped in the budget, and so when people are moving line items in the budget, it's always one that's likely a target. So we don't like to count our chickens before they hatch on that one.
Okay. Well, that would be nice for you, just given the agreement that you've settled with Summit County.
It would be. I think it would make more dollars into the co-op programs, which 22 counties have been participating in with applications and matching funds. But also, in a year like this next year, we always have to keep in mind a nice chunk of that money goes to the Utah Sports Commission. And the Sports Commission is a big funder of a lot of our sports events up here, especially the freestyle, free skiing, and snowboard world championships next winter. And so these dollars are probably pretty important as it connects to hosting that world championships here.
Okay. What about the transportation bills that we had talked about earlier and had to deal with? Rental cars was one of them.
Yeah. Actually, it had a pretty sizable statewide transient room tax attached to that bill. That we were successful as an industry in getting that removed out of that bill. We understand there is some nexus, but I think it kind of goes into there needs to be a bigger conversation as to transient room taxes and what are they for. And now we have a bill that's out there. It doesn't apply to us. It's to counties of the 4th, 5th, and 6th class, coming from Representative Noel, to use more of the money for transportation. And actually, he's not saying transportation. The bill says road improvements. And so we kind of question, are room taxes really to fill potholes? And what's the bigger picture on this? And what portions of that are visitors' potholes versus locals' potholes? So we're kind of concerned about it. We think there needs to be a much broader conversation about those types of taxes in the future.
All right. So we're safe for
year? On the statewide on that. They're going more to a broader, lower amount. I believe it's a 0.15 sales tax increase across the state. for transportation initiatives.
All right. Liquor laws, any tweaks there? I know that the efforts to kind of push back the institution of the 0.05 blood alcohol content, it's going nowhere.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere. There's two different approaches to that. One was a delay of a number of years. The other was, and I believe the delay also had some components of three other states to adopt it before we would adopt it. That didn't get much traction. The other was had to do with, I believe, the a difference in terms of the penalties between 0.05 and 0.08. And that really hasn't gotten much traction either. We're kind of afraid that, you know, what's been passed last year is going to go through, continue. Its implementation is December 30th of 2018. So we kind of know what we're going to be dealing with media-wise now at the first of the year next year.
Yeah, and this is such a tricky thing. It's like I don't think anybody disagrees
exactly
that we shouldn't have drunk drivers on the
right
road. I mean, I think it's just the nuances to think that you wouldn't know having a glass, maybe two, of wine, whether or not you're going to hit that threshold.
Exactly.
And I think that's just kind of the scary unknown part about it.
It is, and it affects different people different ways, size and shape and... It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out because, I mean, the law will have its own implications and people will interpret that in different ways as a consumer, whether it's a local consumer of alcohol or someone choosing us on a vacation. But how do you, it's going to be really hard in terms of the enforcement side of this thing as well. It's such a low amount. So I think... It's going to be a lot of public relations work, a lot of media relations, because we can anticipate what those stories might look like. We're in a great place because we'll be spinning it in terms of the positive. We've got a great free transit system here. There is no need to get behind the wheel on your vacation here. So I think we'll have to be talking those points.
Okay, and real quick, any update on the Zion Wall issue?
Yeah. Yeah, there's still work being done. It's getting late in the session. I mean, we're down to the last week, and so I don't know if it will be. But there have been a lot of there's been a lot of advancement in terms of people understanding the implications, and especially the implications on a lot of the businesses here in Park City in small spaces, especially Main Street spaces. And when they passed that part of the bill that talked about couldn't be under 21 within 10 feet of the bar. You go into some of our places, you can't physically do that. You can't keep a fire lane, for people to walk through, provide seating, and keep 10 feet. These are narrow buildings. Legislators have been up here. They've been touring them. They've been looking. Hopefully we can get something here that recognizes the fact that these people are up against it, that they have to make a decision now by July 1 of 2018. Do they go for do they change their dining club license to a restaurant license or to a bar license? Those are big decisions. There's not a lot of information as to if they do make changes, is it done right? Because there's not, the DABC still has to come in and approve those items. Might be best course of action is punt and give people another year before that decision has to be made.
Real quick, I just wanted to hit on the plastic bag ban. Again, this is actually all kind of containers themselves, but it did get revived in the Senate.
Yeah.
Do we have our lobby?
We had it on our radar screen. It was out there. It's not something that we've been actively involved in. However, I think people here feel the same way as a lot of us feel, is that, this is local. It's a local issue. This shouldn't be a one size fits all. I understand, the intent behind it in terms of trying to avoid a patchwork of different laws and every store you go into a different rule. But the reality is, I guess some of us believe that best government is the government closest to us. And the fact that we have people in the state that are now going to dictate what we can do in terms of plastic bag ban, I just think it's not heading in the right direction. And so we'll see what happens in the House on that. And I mean, obviously, there's things that we can be doing as from a voluntary standpoint, if perchance that goes. But it's a disappointment.
Okay, Bill, leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
We'll
talk to you after the session wraps up.
Okay, thank you.
It's Bill Malone, Executive Director of Park City Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.